The reading this morning is from Daniel chapter 2. We should all be familiar with this reading. We've studied this over the last two or three weeks about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partially of iron and partially of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole world." This is the dream. Now we'll tell the interpretation of it.
Hopefully that's all right. I appreciate you reading that for me. We're not going to specifically talk about the dream. We're not going to specifically talk about the interpretation of that dream. What I'd like to talk about is this page, right between the book of Malachi and the book of Matthew. What I want to talk about is everything that happens that was prophesied during that dream. I want to talk about the pages between the two testaments, the intertestamental period. When we pick up in the Gospels, things are drastically different. We pick up in the Gospels, and now there is a Roman Empire. We go from a Persian Empire to a Roman Empire. How did they get there? What happened? We go from Luke, and Luke is written in Greek. Greek was not even really thought about when the book of Daniel was written. It was not a worldwide language. Everybody speaks it. Everybody reads it. How did that come about? How did these things come to be? There is a Jewish leadership made up of Pharisees, made up of Sadducees, not talked about in the Old Testament whatsoever. Where do they come from? How do we get there? There's a ruling council that seems to somehow intercede between these Romans and these Pharisees and the Jewish people, and they call them the Sanhedrin. Where did they come from? There are people called Herods, and they just seem to spring out of nowhere. How do we get from Malachi to Matthew? And it is like the whole world changed. And the simple answer is that the whole world changed. That's exactly what happened. 400 years pass, and for us it's a flip of the page. 400 years pass. The United States is barely 250 years old. We are barely halfway through 400 years period. It is a long time. But to understand what happens in the Gospels, we need to understand. We don't have to, but it helps if we can understand what happens between these two pages. What happened in this period of time? How do we get to the time of Jesus? So that when we read his Gospels, when we read that good news, that message, it maybe hits us a little bit more. We understand it a little bit deeper. Now, imagine if I came up to you. My dad was a history teacher for many years. And he was a U.S. history teacher. All of our vacations were U.S. history vacations. We went to battlefields. We went to places that important documents were written, and that's all we did every summer. We went to places he wanted to see, because that's what he taught. And if he came up and he said, "I'm going to teach you United States history in one class, 250 years, good luck. But we're going to try to do 400 years. So obviously this is an overview. This is a forest through the trees approach. But there are significant things that happen before we get to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John chapter 1. They're important things that happen. I'd like to look at some of those things because things have changed significantly. So what changed? What happened? How do we get to these periods? Well, there is more than you might think in the Bible about this period, this intertestamental period. If you would mark your Bibles in the book of Daniel, we will not spend a very specific verses of there, but we're going to be flipping back and forth through the book of Daniel. This will not be a history lesson per se, but there are things in history that we will need to talk about to get to more Bible topics, more things that we're talking about. Now, the first thing we need to talk about before we pick up in Daniel is the name. I'm going to slip up at some point, and I'm going to call this the period of silence. If you were raised in the church, if you spend time, that is a period people call the period of silence. It rolls off the tongue. I feel like I've been conditioned to say it, and I'm trying to break it. But I will say that at some point. Bear with me. I believe a better name is the intertestamental period. Because was God really silent? From Malachi to the book of Matthew, was he silent? Because up until that point, when Zechariah walks into the temple and he sees Gabriel standing there, God had not spoken to his people verbally. He had not sent a messenger to his people. There was nothing new that had been sent. But was he silent? I believe the answer is no. There had not been a prophet for 400 years, a messenger for 400 years. There had been no new revelation. This is the period that I want to talk about. But it was prophesied about. It was prophesied about. In Amos chapter 8, we will not turn there. Amos chapter 8, God tells the people, Amos was sent to Israel. He was a Judean prophet, but he was sent to Israel. And he starts with several prophecies about surrounding nations. And Israel liked that because he's talking bad about other nations. But once he hit home, he gets to the eighth nation. He says, you, and you're worse than all of those seven that I talked about beforehand. They didn't like it. They tried to send him home. They had some people come up to him. They said, you know, you'd be better off among your own people, those people down in Judah. You know, if you worry about your life, I'd probably go home and stop talking to us. But in Amos 8, verse 11, God tells them through Amos, he said, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will send a famine on the land. And it will not be a famine of bread, nor of thirst for water. It'll be a famine of hearing the words of the Lord. And by the time Malachi comes around and proclaims the thing God has for him, there was a 400-year famine. A 400-year famine of people wanting to hear more from God, and they just don't get it. Because he doesn't send them to them. So we have these 400 years. You know, God was not silent from Malachi to Matthew. He still spoke through his law. Is God silent today? Was God silent after John wrote that revelation on the island of Patmos? It's been 2,000 years. Would you say he is silent today? No. Because he speaks through his law. He's just spoken and he has written everything that we need to know. They were the people of this time period, during this intertestamental period, they were left with what God wanted them to know. He said, here's the law. This is what I want. There's somebody who is coming and he's going to crush Satan's head. You've read about this all the way back in Genesis. There's someone coming. He will crush that adversary's head. There's someone coming who's going to pave the path for that man. He's going to come in the spirit of Elijah. Keep my law and wait. And that is how Malachi ends. He tells them everything they need to know. Wait. And so for 400 years, they wait. He told them what they need to know. Well, now we've been in a 2,000-year period, roughly, of waiting. God is not silent. He told us what we needed to know. He told us what he wanted us to know. He says there is a throne. He says there are books that are going to be opened, and one of those books is the book of life. And this is what you need to get your name written in that book of life. This is what you need to do so that you can be in that kingdom. I'm going to send that Messiah back, and he's going to raise his people. Wait on it. And we are just in a 2,000-year period of waiting, but God is not silent. So I believe a better name is the intertestamental period, the period between that last prophecy of Malachi and that prophecy from Gabriel to Zechariah, talking about John. Now, if you will, Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. This is where we will pick up. Beginning in verse 17. But this is the chapter when Nebuchadnezzar talks about how great he is, how wonderful he is. And God says, you're going to have to go eat grass for a while. You're going to have to go spend some time out in the woods, living like an animal so you can see who really is in power. And there are some things before that happens that God wants Nebuchadnezzar to know. Look with me, if you will, in verse 17. Daniel chapter 4, verse 17. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he grants it to whomever he wishes, and he sets it over even the lowliest of people. Look at verse 25, the last part of verse 25. And seven periods of time will wash over you, until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he bestows it on whoever he wishes. Go to verse 32. Same thing, last part of the verse. And seven periods of time are going to pass over you until you recognize the Most High as ruler over the realm of mankind, and he bestows it on whomever he wishes. 400 years from Malachi to Matthew, do we see God is still ruling over the kingdoms of man, that he is still rising up and pulling down nations. He is using them to his purposes, and it is all working towards something. It is not random happenstance. It is not accident. It is going towards a goal. And we can see through his providence, through his foretelling of these things, they rise and fall at his will, when he wants them to, how he wants them to, and he uses them for a purpose. And this is what he wants Nebuchadnezzar to know. And then he shows Nebuchadnezzar that, and he takes him from the highest point of a world power, and he makes him like an animal crawling on the ground. I want you to know that I am over the kingdoms of men. And if we know that and we study this period, we can start to see that as we go from one kingdom to the next, working our way to Rome, working our way to Jesus. And then can we see that working from Rome all the way to the United States of America, that God is still ruling in the kingdoms of men. So what happened to bring this about? If you will, turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. Just flip back a page or so. Daniel chapter 2 works hand in hand with Daniel 7 and 8. The whole book is like a rainbow. The beginning works with the end and you go towards the middle. Daniel 2 works with 7 and 8. And in 7 and 8, we have these visions of a sea, and there are different animals walking out of it. And in chapter 2, we get to see this statue. And it has different heads and different, made out of different metals, made out of different elements. And these correlate to one another. So as we have these animals coming out, we also have this statue. So in chapter 2, we have this statue, and we don't have to talk about this period of silence for the first two nations mentioned in that statue. We get them by name. We get to see them and their rise and their fall. We get to see that. God gives us that by inspiration. We get to see a lot of that through Daniel. We get to see a lot of that as we go through the minor prophets, because Persia, for most of those, is still there. We get to see this. Now, in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 38. Daniel chapter 2, verse 38. And into whose hands he is given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you ruler of them all. You, talking to Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. The head of gold is Babylon. It ruled as an empire. It couldn't have been better. Y'all had that handout. It's got all of these names, got all of these dates. Keep that. It is very useful. For 70 years, Babylon ruled. The Chaldeans ruled. Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC. We don't have to remember these dates. I'm just going to use them so it helps us keep up with the passage of time as we go. 562 BC, Nebuchadnezzar dies. In a six-year period, there are four kings of the Babylonian Empire. In one word, that is instability. In another word, that is train wreck. Four kings, 6 years. There is an assassination. There is a coup attempt. There is another assassination. They are very, very weak. Now we come to Daniel chapter 5. In Daniel chapter 5, now it is not a lion walking out of the sea. Now it's a bear. Now it's not a head of gold. Now it is a chest of silver. And we don't have to guess who this nation is. We don't have to guess anything about it. We get to see it. We get to see that Chaldean downfall. We get to see in the minor prophets where it is prophesied that they're going to fall to their drinking parties. And what happens? They have a siege placed around them. Through history, we get to see that the rivers were diverted that ran in to that city. Nineveh had great waters that went through it. They diverted those waters and they walked right in underneath the cisterns. Go into the city, and what are the leaders doing? They're having a drinking party. We get to see that hand come up on the wall. It says, you've been numbered, you've been weighed, you've been divided, you've been found wanting. We see all of it. And somebody else comes into power. Now we have that bear. Now we have that chest of silver. Daniel 5, look in verse 31. Daniel 5, 31. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. The Medes and the Persians ruled for roughly 200 years. 536 to somewhere around the 331 or so. 200 years they ruled. They were very tolerant towards God's people. They're very tolerant towards the Jews. They allowed Zerubbabel to come back. They allowed him to start rebuilding. They got to rebuild the wall. They got to rebuild the temple. This is during the days of Esther. Esther was highly regarded. She was allowed to walk into the king's presence without an invitation. Could have been a death sentence. She was allowed to come before. She was allowed to have a petition before him. She saved her people. Because what did he know? Maybe she was appointed for such a time as this. She was. She saved her people. Very highly respected. Very highly taken care of. This is the time of Ezra, who was allowed to return. This is the time of Nehemiah, who twice was allowed to return. They were given things to build the temple, to build the walls. They were given supplies. God's people were taken care of during the Medo-Persians. Now, there was no pressure, there was no persecution for the most part under this. They were allowed to do the religious things that they needed to follow God's law. And when Malachi ends, that's where we're at. Persia is still in control. Persia is still over the people's actions. And when they're in charge, that good treatment always continues all the way to 331 BC. Now, turn with me to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. Now it is no longer a bear. Now it's a ram. Now we get to see some prophecy. We get to see even more things told into the future. Now it is not a bear, it is a ram. It is not a chest of silver. Now it is a belly, thighs of bronze. That's where the power of the body comes from. It's from your inner, from your core, from your thighs. This is a powerful nation. This is a strong nation. It is a ram. In John chapter 14, we don't have to turn there, but in John chapter 14, verse 29, Jesus says, "Now I tell you things before it happens, so that when it happens, you may believe." Who are we talking about? God wasn't silent. He tells us who this nation is going to be. And we don't get to read about them in the Bible. But they were prophesied about. And these things can build our faith as we see these prophecies. And then we look through history and we see them falling about, just as God said they would. Look in Daniel chapter 8, beginning in verse 21. Daniel 8, verse 21. "And then the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And there will be a large horn that's between its eyes." That's the first kingdom. "Called by name hundreds of years before it happened." Greece is going to be the third kingdom. And that's exactly what happens. So there's going to be one very, very strong horn. And we're going to look at that. So from 361 to 167 BC, roughly, we get to see the Hellenistic Empire rise. Persia, like Babylon, ends kind of on a fizzle. They started out strong, they end very weakly. As Persian influence begins to decline, as their power begins to lower and lessen, there's a man named Philip of Macedonia who comes up and he gathers several of these Greek city-states. The name Philip of Macedonia may sound familiar. Paul, remember, he got a Macedonian call. The first city he goes to, Philippi, it's named after this man. He begins bringing these Greek city-states together, starts creating a small army, starts leading groups and battalions, and eventually they've gotten pretty powerful. And while Philip of Macedonia is not incredibly important to our study, his son is Alexander the Great. His son Alexander comes into power at about 20. His father was assassinated. But Alexander comes in at the age of 20, and he was bred for this. He was born for this. He was raised for this. His personal tutor, his father had gotten Aristotle to be his tutor. I don't know who our teachers were as we were growing up, but it wasn't Aristotle. One of the three greatest philosophers that we ever had, at least in modern history. That was his personal tutor. That's who he went to for advice. He gathers an army, and within 5 years, they take over the known world. 5 years. They gather an army, and it became the world's first full-time army. It was not people who were farmers or peasants or shopkeepers and merchants. These were people whose only job was to be a soldier, and they were good at it. And it took them 5 years to become the world power. Jerusalem is a part of that conquering, is a part of that world that they've taken over. Very similarly to the Persians, they were allowed peace. They were allowed to do pretty much what they wanted. Greece treats them very well. And why is this important? Because there's a lot of providence that happens through the kingdom of Greece. We get to see God's word spread through the kingdom of Greece. This is important because Alexander drank his own Kool-Aid. Alexander truly believed that the Greek culture, the Hellenistic culture, was the greatest culture that the world has ever seen. It was the best thing that has ever happened, and he wanted to share it with everybody and anybody. He captured you, he conquered you, and he wanted to make you like them. He taught people how to read like them. He taught people how to talk like them. He taught people how to live like them. By the time that we get to the New Testament, Paul ends up on an island and he calls them barbarians because they didn't speak Greek. If you didn't know Greek, you were a barbarian. You weren't cultured, you weren't civilized. Now, why is this important? This is important because this is the exact opposite of what happens during the Tower of Babel. There was a time when God told people to spread throughout the world. They didn't do it. They stayed together. You know, we all talk together. We can work. We can build great things. God changed their languages. He made them spread out. Well, now the time of spreading is over. Now there's time for a unified language throughout the world, a time where people can start understanding one another, can start spreading ideals to one another, and that's exactly what Greece does. Now, can we see the providence in that? So by the time we get to 285 BC, Septuagint comes up. And it sounds like a fancy word, it's not. We all know what octagons are, we know what pentagons are, we know what a septagon is. Seven. Septuagint, 70 of the world's greatest translators come in at Alexandria. There used to be a great library there. And they transcribe God's law from Genesis to Malachi. It is now written in Greek. It goes from a small, isolated language in a small, isolated section of the world. We go from Israel, who spoke Hebrew, written in Hebrew, that very few people understood, that very few people cared about. Now, it is written in a language that everybody understands and is in a language that now everybody can read because literacy was very important to the Greeks. They taught people how to read. There were people who could read Greek and they couldn't read their own languages that they grew up speaking. Can we see God's providence in that? Now, there are copies of God's law spread throughout the world in languages that people can read. There are Jews who did not come back to Jerusalem after they were sent off to captivity, after they were sent to Assyria, after they were sent to Babylon. Not everybody went back. Some people spread out. Some people went to Egypt. Some people never went to captivity. They left and they went southwest. There are Jews all throughout the world. Now, copies of their law are being sent out. Copies of their law that they can read when previously they might not have been able to, even when it was in Hebrew. Can we see God's providence in using the Greeks? Everybody spoke Greek. Everybody reads Greek. Now, come with me to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. We'll look in verse 22. Alexander dies relatively young, very young. He was an incredibly bright star and he burned out fast. But what happens after he dies? Believe it or not, that was prophesied about too. In Daniel 8, look in verse 22. Let's back up. We'll reread 21. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, that ram. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king, the first great king, that's Alexander. But in verse 22, and then the horn breaks, and four horns come up in its place, and they represent four kingdoms that will arise from his nation, although not with his power. So just read that. What do you think happens to the Greek Empire? Alexander dies and his four greatest generals split it into four quadrants. And they start vying for power. But they were never as powerful as Greece when Alexander was in control. It's prophesied about. We can see God's power and we can believe these things. And that helps us believe the gospel. Because we see him prophesying about things hundreds of years in advance. And it happened exactly like he said that it would. Exactly like his prophet said that it would. So after this dogfight breaks out among Alexander's generals, they start trying to reconquer areas that were already conquered, because they wanted people to understand that they were the one in control. Israel is a part of that. Israel goes from a time of Persian captivity where they were pretty much allowed to do whatever they wanted to. Then they go to Greek captivity, and they're still, for the most part, allowed to do what they wanted to. When the generals come into play, when the Greek nation starts to hit that decline, things change and they change drastically. There is a group that comes up called the Seleucids. Seleucids are not great for God's people. They're not great for the Israelites. They're not tolerant. And there is specifically a man of the Seleucids that they were led by a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. He was an awful man. He was a terrible man. He was cruel. He was violent. He was hateful. And he had two goals towards God's people, towards the Israelites. He wanted to, one, eliminate the Jewish people, point blank. And he did that by murder, he did that by torture, he did that by imprisonment, he did that by slavery, he just wanted them gone. And to help in that, he wanted to eliminate their religion. He wanted to eliminate their law. He did that, he started with forbidding circumcision. Now, I'm not going to let your children follow this law. When they get up, maybe they won't even want to do it. He forbids sacrifices. You're not going to be able to follow your own law as an adult. Furthermore, he tried to burn every copy of the law that he could find. You're not going to be able to read it. You're not going to be able to teach it to people. And you're going to start stopping following this God of yours. The reason he says that is because he believes that he is Zeus incarnate. He had a God persona. He thought he was Zeus in the flesh. So as he comes along, he wants them to denounce Jehovah. He wants them to worship him as their savior, as their leader. So now God's people are being severely punished. They're being hurt. They're being persecuted. They're being killed, tortured. They have women who are being raped. And this kicks off an era of Jewish independence. It lasts about 100 years. Now in 167 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes finally goes too far for the Jewish people. They accept they are being persecuted. They don't really do anything about it. But Antiochus Epiphanes walks into the most holy place, the holy of holy places, and he offers a pig right there. Makes everything unholy. Makes everything unclean. Now, the Jews were led by a great leader. There was a priest named Mattathias who happened to be there. Antiochus sacrifices this pig inside of the temple. Then they walk out and they have other soldiers and they say, you are going to offer a sacrifice right here to Antiochus. And Mattathias said, no, we will not. And another Jew, another priest who is there, walks forward and says, you're going to get us all killed. He starts to go offer this sacrifice for Antiochus. And Mattathias finds a sword and he kills that man before he makes it up to the steps of the temple. This kicks off this Jewish rebellion. This kicks off what we eventually call the Maccabean rebellion. He had five sons. One of them, his name was Judas Maccabee. They called him the Hammer. And everybody else said, well, I'll swing my hammer with you. We'll follow you. We'll do whatever you need. Another one of Mattathias' sons, he ends up taking over the priesthood after they lead this guerrilla warfare, after they start fighting against these Seleucids. And you say, what, Ty, why does this matter? Look in John chapter 10. John chapter 10. This is important because Jesus observed this event. After the temple has been made unclean, after it has been profaned, after they have this rebellion, after they push away these Seleucids and they begin to realize, you know, we are taking care of ourselves again. We are free for the moment. They rededicate the temple. They call it the Feast of Rededication, the Feast of Dedication. Today we call that Hanukkah. It just happened about a month and a half ago. The Feast of Dedication. Why does this matter? Because Jesus honored the Feast of Dedication. It was not one of the three main feasts that they had to do. This was not Passover. This was not Pentecost. This was not the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. But in John chapter 10, look at verse 22. At that time, the Feast of Dedication took place in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked into the temple area to the Porch of Solomon. The Jews surrounded him, and then he begins teaching. Jesus did not condemn them for this. But this happened during what we call a period of silence. God was still at work with his people. He was still at work in the kingdoms of men. And he did not condemn them for celebrating such things that happened as they followed as his providence took place. Jesus honored this. This was something Jesus partook in. And it's not something that's mentioned in the Old Testament at all. It's an intertestamental period feast. Jesus took part in it. But if we just start reading, what is this? It's Hanukkah. So we have this Maccabean revolt. And during this time of independence, there is another group that comes up, another group that we hear about a lot in the New Testament. And they say, we messed up. We went too far into this Hellenistic ideals. These Greeks came in and they changed us. We were supposed to be separate. We're supposed to be a single cloth. We're not supposed to be interwoven fibers. We're not supposed to be like them. And now we're speaking their language. We're reading their language. We went too far. We can't let it happen again. And this group comes up and they take Ezekiel 22:30, where God said, you know, I wish somebody would just build a wall around the temple because nobody's doing what I want them to do. I wish there was a hedge around it. This group comes up and they say, well, we'll be the hedge. We'll be the wall. We'll make sure nobody leaves God's law again. We'll make sure nobody goes too far again. And we call them the Pharisees. This is where they come into the picture. They say, you know what? People are doing too much on the Sabbath day. They're walking too far on the Sabbath day. We've got all this commerce. We've got all these things. Well, guess what? Now you can only take so many steps. We're going to call it a Sabbath day journey. You're not even going to get close to breaking God's law. You're going to keep our traditions. And then, you know, they say, there are ceremonial cleansing laws. Do you remember those? Sometimes you might forget about them and you're not clean when you need to be. Well, you're going to get cleansed on this day and this day and this day. You'll never not be cleansed. Your home will never not be cleansed. The temple will never not be cleansed. Everything will be ready. Don't worry about it. We're going to stop you. We will be a wall between you and passing God's law. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the idea that they wanted to say, I want to make sure I don't even come close to overstepping God's law. The issue became when they started thinking that their law was the equivalent of God's law. When they started treating people who went past their traditions as overstepping God's traditions. And it was not the same. So by the time that we get back and we're in the days of Jesus, these hedges, these traditions, they are now more important to some people than God's actual law. They hold them in more high esteem than God's actual law. And so there comes a time when Jesus is breaking those traditions, the traditions of man. And they say, well, why do you break God's traditions? Why do you not honor the law? And he says, I do. I just don't honor yours. I don't honor your law because it is not God's law. And they did not like that. They didn't like it at all. It came to a point when they thought, we need to kill this man because of this. He thinks he's better than us. He thinks he knows more than us. We saved our people with these laws. We brought them back out of a dark time with these laws. And by the time we get to the New Testament, there are 6,000 of these guys running around leading God's people. And unfortunately, they're leading God's people astray. That is how they come about. That's how we get there. So now back in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel 7 and 8, we come back and it is 63 B.C. It's 63 B.C. and that period, that 100-year period of Jewish independence, it's gone. It is over. Daniel is no longer speaking about lions, and it's no longer a bear, it's no longer a ram. The last thing that comes out is just a monster. It's a beast. It's like something he's never seen before. It was iron. It was hard. It was brutal. And it was uncaring. It was Rome. And it is like something the world has never seen before. It's like something, honestly, the world has never seen since. Rome was a different animal. And from 63 BC to roughly 470 AD, 500 years, Rome ruled the world with an iron fist. We as a country, we are not even halfway to where Rome was. What they did was incredible. What God allowed them to do as he worked with them through the kingdoms of man was incredible. Rome takes over. They rise up under a man named Pompey. Pompey does a very similar thing that Antiochus Epiphanes does. As he conquers Israel, as he conquers Judah, he walks right into the temple. I've conquered these people. I want to see what it's about. Let me see their temple. Let me see what their God is. Walks right into the most holy place. It is profaned again. They have to rededicate it again. And now they have a temple that has twice been profaned by worldly men. Twice been profaned by rulers of a different country, a different nationality, not God's people. And the Jewish people are very mad. They're very upset. And while it's been 100 years, there are still Jewish patriots. There are still Maccabean patriots. There are still relatives of these people, and they don't like it. Rome, for the most part, allowed freedom of the people that they conquered. They allowed them to follow their own religions. They allowed them to follow their own laws. For the most part, their civil freedoms were intact. You're going to keep Roman law. You're going to pay Roman taxes. You're going to render to Caesar what is Caesar's. But if you want to pay your own taxes amongst yourselves, you want to keep your own laws, that's fine. You do what you need to. But they set up a system to get from these people of Judah, these other surrounding satellite nations they take over. They have a way to communicate with Caesar. They set up kings to rule these areas. We call them Herods. That's where they come from. That's how they come about. Now, these Herods get to Canaan, and it does not take them long to realize that the Jewish people are not happy, They are distraught. They are upset. What can we do to fix it? We have these zealots. We have these Maccabeans, and they're rebelling against us. I say against us, against Herod. And Herod knows if there is a rebellion in his land, what happens to Herod? Herod gets killed, and they set up another one. He'll take care of it. He'll take care of Rome, because obviously that guy can't do his job. So he's worried. He says, I need to squash this rebellion. That's exactly what he does. He sends in the army. They come in with an iron fist, and they crush any hope of Jewish rebellion, any hope of Jewish freedom. But now they're still upset. Now you've killed our friends and family. Now you've killed the people that we believe, you know, they were the better Jews. They were the people who were willing to fight for us, to take care of us. You came in and you desecrated our temple, the holiest thing that we have. And so Herod says, well, you know, what can I do? How can I appease these people? How can I make things better? Turn to John chapter 2. John chapter 2. What will calm down the Jewish people? What will make them listen to us? Because I want to keep my job as king. This is a cushy job. This is a good job, and I'm over them. How can I make them be quiet? John chapter 2, look in verse 20. Actually, verse 19. Jesus answered them. He said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. And the Jews said, it took 46 years to build this temple. And you think you'll raise it up in 3 days? They built them a temple. So how can we make these people happy? Sorry about your temple. We messed up. What if we just tear it down? We build you a new one. We'll build you a nice one. Will that make things better? Rome sends 1,000 architects to Jerusalem. And over a period of 46 years, they built a phenomenal piece of architecture for the Jews. That is what it took to pacify these people. You remember how long it took Solomon to build his? 7 years. You remember Zerubbabel's temple when they built the second one. It took them 4.5 years. And after they finished it, the people who were old enough to remember Solomon's, they cried. It wasn't fancy enough. 46 years of some of the world's greatest architects who ever lived. You can't deny it, because we still have people who go on vacation specifically to see things these people built. They're still standing. That's who built this temple. And it took them 46 years to do it. Pacified God's people. And that made them subservient to the Romans. That's what got the rebellion to stop. So finally, we have a temple. And we're at the temple that Jesus would have taught outside of. We have a temple that Jesus would have went to for Passovers as he followed all of those feasts that were prescribed to them, as he kept God's law. This is how it got there. It was just an offering to pacify God's people, to make them stand under another country, under a foreign ruler. And they went with it. This is the world Jesus was born into. So when Jesus is born, there is now a Roman Empire. Herods are in control. The Pharisees work as Jewish religious leaders. Say, we'll take care of you. We'll stop these ideals from seeping into our livelihoods. We'll keep you pure. We'll keep you whole. Everybody is speaking Greek, and now we know how. Now we know how it got there. So in Matthew chapter 2, when we read about some of Jesus' birth, Jesus is born into a world with a Herod who's very worried that there might be another king who's been born, because he's got people who tell him, who can read Greek. He's got people who've read the old law. They come up and they say, hey, Book of Malachi says there's somebody coming. He's going to come during the fourth kingdom. I don't know if you can count, but we're number four. Something's coming. So the Jews are now saying there's a king that's coming. Herod doesn't like it. Because if an insurrection comes up under his watch, he's the one who gets killed for it. He's the one who loses his job as a Roman official. So in Matthew chapter 2, verse 16, Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi. He became very enraged. He sent men. He killed all the boys who were in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years and under, according to the time that had been determined from the wise men. So are we shocked at this point that he's trying to kill children? Sometimes it's easy to read that. Oh, how could you do that? This is a Herod who had already killed two of his own sons because he thought they were trying to take his place. This is a Herod who later on will have his own wife killed because he thinks she's trying to lead a coup against him. He is a terrible, horrible man. And you think he cares about little babies of people who are not his own nationality, who are under his thumb? No. This is the world Jesus is born into. Roman rule, Greek language, Greek culture, Pharisees, Herods, synagogues. Sanhedrin, this is what he was. So in Daniel chapter 2, when we read these things, now we know how it all fits. Daniel chapter 2, look in verse 40. And then there will be a fourth kingdom. It is as strong as iron. Just as iron smashes and crushes everything, just like iron that crushes it will smash and crush all of these things. That gives us the context. There is, during this fourth kingdom, something else is going to happen. Look in verse 44. And in the days of those kings, talking about that kingdom of iron, talking about that beast, that monster that walks out of the sea, the Roman Empire. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. In that kingdom, there will not be left for another people. It will crush and it will put an end to all of these kingdoms. And it itself will endure forever. Another kingdom comes in during the reign of that fourth kingdom. The strongest kingdom. A kingdom that roughly 1,500 years later, nobody else has come close to copying. For a long, long time, they were powerful. And during that, it says, something else is coming, it's going to crush it. It's going to make it fall. It's a rock, and it's going to roll over, it's going to hit that thing, and it's just going to crumble. Because while it was iron, it was held with clay. This is a solid rock, a solid foundation, a strong country. And this one's not going to fall. This is going to last forever. And we've already gone for quite a while. The United States of America, through providence, has risen to a great place. But what kingdom do we want to be a part of? There have been many kingdoms that have risen and fallen as God works in the kingdoms of men, all towards His providence. All towards His plan. The difference is we just can't see what that plan is just yet. We don't get to know why He wants certain kingdoms to rise and fall. We're in a period of silence, but God is not silent. He is still speaking, and He speaks through His law. He's told us everything that He wants us to know, everything that we need to know. There are things I want to know. He says, you don't need to know it yet. Hopefully one day I will. But we are all citizens of a country. We are all citizens of a kingdom, but there's only one kingdom that is eternal. And if we are not a part of that kingdom, that spiritual kingdom, that eternal kingdom, then we need to change our allegiance. We need to change our citizenship. And the way that we do that, if you're already a citizen who has fallen short, who has missed the mark, we do that by repentance. If we are not a citizen at all, we do that still by hearing, by believing that law, the word that He has told us. He said, this is enough. This is what you need to know. We hear it, we believe it. That leads us to confessing that I've messed up, that I fell short. We are baptized, we follow that law. And then we rise up in newness of life. We rise up as a citizen of that kingdom, that eternal kingdom. And then we strive for the rest of our lives to follow the laws of that kingdom. To do what we can, when we can, with the time that we have. Now, we talked about in our previous lesson, we can't buy more time. But we do have time now. And if anyone needs to do anything, whether that is to come forward and repent, to get back into God's law, to maintain our citizenship, or if we need to become a citizen of that kingdom, let's do that while we stand, while we sing the invitation song.
Come. before taking the Lord's Supper, let's say number 155. Number 155. And faith in high and holy.